This is a lecture by L. Ron Hubbard given on the 6th of October, 1956. The title of this lecture is Uses of Scientology. This lecture is 63 minutes long. Reproduced by Golden Arrow Productions.
Now, the point that I'd like to make this afternoon have to do with the uses of Scientology. Would you like to hear something of that? Well, factually, I don't know why we ever called Scientology or Dianetics psychotherapy. I haven't the vaguest notion. The vaguest notion today, as I look back on it, why they ever fitted into any category of psychotherapy. In the first place, Scientology works. In the second place, we have nothing to do with the textbook type neurotic or psychotic. We don't handle these people. We just handle the average citizen. That's close enough, Roger. But the point I wish to make is that we really do not traffic in this particular field. And it's one of the facts of this that we can do more in that field than has been done in that field. It hasn't anything to do with our ability to operate in the field, is we just don't operate in the field. And take the field of healing in general. We could operate in that field and very often inadvertently do operate in that field because we process somebody and he gets well. But truth of the matter is we do not do too much directly on this subject of healing. We don't go along and see somebody with epiglottitis or something and say, well, we could do something for that. Just as the only thing we're doing. We do that, by the way. It's great temptation. Look at this fellow, this wonderful game. He's got this wonderful game of being deaf in one ear and dermatitis all over his nose or something of the sort, and just take that game right away from him. It's a mean thing for us to do, but that's healing. It's taking people's protections away from them. People seldom beat up sick men, and men who wish to protect themselves very often get sick. But what we do is so different than anything man has done before that man has no place to put this subject. And that becomes very difficult then. You don't have a classification neatly in which you can put Scientology. Say, bang, well, that is a, you know, it's a giraffe, or it belongs to the species Botanicae or something. It has speckled spots, therefore it, you know. It doesn't classify easily. It stands as it is. And that's because it's doing something that man didn't do before. And man didn't go around increasing the abilities of men. If a fellow had an IQ of 70, that was it. That was it. But we made this fascinating discovery that if an individual was improved, he would improve, providing we invited his own cooperation in the activity. It's almost impossible to worsen anybody. Do you know that? I don't even think you can worsen a Thetan by shooting him. He can get stubborn about getting any worse, or he can get stubborn about being any better. But the truth of the matter is it's very easy to raise his intelligence and ability, and it's very difficult to suppress it. You can take somebody with a 70 IQ, Dianeticist, Scientologist works with him, he gets an IQ of 85, 95, 105, 110. All right, how hard would we have to work to give him an IQ of 65? I don't think we can do it. We've tried. Now, we've seen people get dumber and get brighter, but it's very easy for us after we've made a person very bright to make them slightly dumb. You know, we raised his IQ from 90 to 115. Then by invalidation and breaking the auditor's code in a few dozen directions, we can maybe reduce his IQ to 110, but not to 90. This gets fascinating. In other words, there was a direction nobody was taking. It was a lonely, wide-open road. And that was, let's play a game of being more able. Just because we want to be, not because we have to be. And that road was wide open. It went clear to the horizon, and it's still going. In other words, man was fully prepared to get better. Well, in view of the fact that everybody before us believed completely that you could not change men, you couldn't change their IQ, you couldn't change their personality profiles, you couldn't alter anybody, I have to comment that their direction must have been to try to make him worse. Now, that's a snide conclusion to reach. I shouldn't. It's really not called for me to make that bold and vicious a statement. I mean, I shouldn't come right out here in front of all of you and God and everybody and say flat-footedly that the intentions of psychology is to make men into mice. I shouldn't say that, even if it's true. But if anybody had had an intention of making his fellow man better, I think he would have made the grade. I mean, I really think he would have made the grade. What they wanted to do was inhibit them more to make them better. That's the wrong equation. You've got to free them up to make them better. You had to be able to grant freedom. And that took people who were willing to grant life and grant beings. And maybe there weren't any on earth before us. So maybe we're a brand new breed of cat. I don't know. Apparently, as we have swung along the line for the last 6 years, and here in England particularly the last 3 years, we're pretty lucky cats as far as the scientific world is concerned, as far as the world of man is concerned. Actually, the general public and people in general are very, very happy to have us around. But something new is happening. We're doing something different. We must have a different intention than people had before. Now, given that we might be brighter than others, given that scientific technology might have mounted up to a point where we had tools delivered into our hands by which we could figure things out that man hadn't been able to figure out before, but you look in essence at the basics of Scientology and you find the woof and warp of life itself. Scientology is life. That is all it is. It's study of. Not really a study of knowledge. That's a misnomer. It's a study of life. Livingness. Well, and as soon as we recognize that we are studying and learning life, another thing happens. We try to classify ourselves again. We're studying life. Then we try to classify ourselves in terms of something life is doing, and we can't do it. Don't you see how odd this would be? Here we are. We study this. Well, let's get the idea of a pyramid. We're studying everything in the pyramid from this point. And now, in order to identify ourselves, we have to run down the side of the pyramid and say we're this stone. You get the idea? We are studying the whole subject of life. The only doingness with which we have any acquaintance in this universe is life's doingness, you see? Life is doing this and that in this universe, and it has various subdivisions of its doingness. And now we are studying life's doingness and beingness and havingness. We're studying that whole subject. Now, to classify ourselves easily becomes impossible, because the only level of understanding that exists, of course, is straight there in this little bracket of one of life's doingnesses. And we monitor all of them. So how are we to define ourselves? How are we to explain ourselves? Well, there are many ways to do this. There's only one other subject back through history that really did improve people. There was one. There was one. If not too improperly used, it really did improve people. And you've all been subjected to it, and you consider it so much the woof and warp of beingness that you would hardly consider it a subject at all, and that's education. By a process of study, somebody becomes brighter, at least, upon a particular subject. Maybe his IQ doesn't change, you see, but he becomes brighter on a subject. His IQ goes along ordinarily according to his studies and developments, but mainly according to how many years old he is. And education followed this up, and therefore there was a subject there whereby in any particular field a person became brighter on the subject of engineering if one studied engineering. A person would have found it difficult to become brighter about engineering unless one studied engineering, don't you see? So there is a parallel subject. There is a parallel subject. And studying this, it's a harmonic of Scientology. So Scientology is monitoring, can free or square life around, you see. It can inhibit or free or repurpose or take purposes out of life. But education is a sort of a lower harmonic of this. A person is invited to study, clay modeling in order to do clay modeling. And they had certain means of bringing the information of how do you clay model across to somebody else. Therefore, if we look over education, we'll find out that one of the quickest things that transmits to somebody else's mind, if he says, what is Scientology? What is this anyway? One of the quickest responses that you would find the most agreement with and you could talk most about with him, that is to say this is the most basic agreement, would be, say, it is a new method of educating people. Not a shallow look. But nevertheless, we could say that. See, I mean, just to dispose of the conversation or carry it on light vein. We could simply say, well, it's a new method of educating people. Well, what importance does this have if we could talk this glibly in the field of education? And believe me, you, as a Scientologist, can talk this glibly in the field of education. You just start talking about ARC. Fit ARC to education. Oh, you can talk to somebody for hours. You can talk to a teacher who has studied it all of her life, maybe. You can talk about this and you'll find instant agreement. Why? In the subject of education itself, you've located the kingpins. It isn't true that you're paralleling education. You're actually monitoring it and everything else too. All right. We talk about ARC. Have you ever tried to teach a child who was mad at you? Opening question. Well, how would you teach such a child anything if he was chronically mad at you? Well, the answer has always been get mad at the child. Only that didn't work either. Supposing you had a method by which you could take an angry child, you would say to this teacher, and actually successfully teach the child something. Child's been angry at us all this time. Well, if you just have the child touch your hands one after the other, and maybe touch the tip of your nose, you'll find you're no longer talking to an angry child. Now, the entering wedge would be, how do you persuade an angry child to do that? Well, actually, it takes some persuasion. But if you could do that, then your child would change tone, and you'd no longer be talking to an angry child. As silly as this. Well, a teacher would be quite interested. And as a matter of fact, when teachers look over this subject at large, they have a tendency to slightly overwhelm because it so thoroughly embraces education. It so thoroughly explains its vagaries and its upsets and its drawbacks that it becomes very impossible for them to understand how it was not known before. And they fall very happily into the idea, well, it sort of must have been known all along because it explains education. And education evolved from something, so it must have evolved from this, you see? That isn't true either. Like Topsy, education just grew. By trial and error, they discovered some empirical methods, 90% of which did not work. I say that very clearly. Any teacher will tell you this. The bulk of educational procedures applied just hit or miss are found in many instances to be very wanting. If you've ever stood a small line of children up and tried to teach them something very elementary, oh, I don't know, some little elementary dance step or something like this, you know how much trouble you can get into and how much randomity can occur just to keep them in line and keep them interested in the dance step. Well, a Scientologist would come along and look at an effort to teach a bunch of children a dance step and would realize something at once, that an adult was unable to accomplish mimicry if from size alone. By the communication formula, the duplication factor is violated by an adult being there. Now, the adult going through the step for the children would be pretty good duplication, except for the size. So the adult then is not the best medium. But the adult could stand back from this and cause communication to take place by taking one child, the most likely these children, and putting that one child through an elementary step with his back facing the other children. Not reverse N2, see, but he's facing the same way the other line of children facing. Put him through that step two or three times, you'd all of a sudden find these other children able to do that first elementary step. Well, we would have applied communication solids, mimicry, you see, and then would have done a gradient scale. We would have worked the dance step out, a Scientologist would have, on a gradient scale of what is the simplest evolution here. The simplest evolution in a dance step, most people, except a Scientologist, would overlook, which is to be able to stand on a dance floor. It's very, very silly. That's the most elementary procedure. And that's the gradient scale. And the reason why the usual dance instructor would have an awful hard time with a small line of children, would expect them to come back for days and days and weeks to this dancing class to learn this simple schottische or whatever it is, is simply because he's never had one of those children yet on the dance floor. And yet the children are standing on a dance floor. The Scientologists tell you the child is probably anywhere but here. In fact, that's the child's best motto. Anywhere but here. All right. Here we have Scientology being applied in teaching somebody something. Isn't true that an auditor is educating his preclear into doing anything. We're outside the field of education when we're doing that. We're into the field of pure communication, pure affinity, and pure reality. In fact, we aren't trying to do as they did in an old-time psychotherapy, make the preclear into the auditor. You realize that the most modern of psychotherapies, invented in 1894 and carried forward for the years since, had as its main goal making the patient into the practitioner. You see, we're not trying to do anything like that. So we're not trying to teach him to do anything. We're not trying to teach him to live with his case, one of the standard remedies. Fellow has arthritis, somebody tells him, well, you'll just have to learn to live with it, that's all. Actually, the main part of a cure for an ulcer, I've heard this said seriously, the main part of a cure for an ulcer is to learn how to live with an ulcer. Damn if I'd ever learn how to live with an ulcer. I just would never study that lesson. I'm afraid I'd study another lesson as to what purgatory do ulcers ordinarily get consigned when considered secondhand. In other words, let's get rid of it. Well, now, however, in the field of education, these factors of affinity, reality, and communication are of such vital importance and explain so much that, as I say, you could, if you were an auditor, teach a bunch of children very easily how to dance a schottische. There'd be nothing to this. dancing a shawty. First, you get them to stand on a dance floor. You take little Johnny and you say, Johnny, we're going to play a game. Stand on the dance floor. Something on this. Johnny would start to fly to pieces. You'd say, come on, Johnny. I'll bet Mary can do it. Mary, come over here. Stand on the dance floor. Now, Johnny, can you stand on the dance floor? See, we furnished him with a mimicry terminal. So he tests it. This time he doesn't fly to pieces. Three cheers. You see, and gradually, one by one, we would get the children there. We would get them into the environment. We would accustom them to the environment with whatever crude kind of HC we wanted to use. And then we would use one of their number facing the same direction as the rest of the class to demonstrate what we then considered the next most elementary step. And we get everybody to do this. And we'd remember that a short attention span was part of this. We wouldn't try to teach them very long at a time. And one right after the other, they'd all learn how to do the shottish. How long would it take you to teach a group of children, you, a Scientologist, a shottish? I don't know, maybe an afternoon. Quite remarkable. In the first place, you wouldn't violate their willingness to do a shottish. You, being somewhat adroit, would demonstrate the glories of a shottish. One way or the other. And they'd all wind up doing shottish. This is for sure. Now, let's compare this method of education that a Scientologist would use to somebody training a radar operator. I'm not mentioning any particular services. We might as well take, though, the United States Navy. That's about the worst of this. I won't call anybody by name in this, but the U.S. Navy radar training establishment leaves much to be desired. In the first place, a little radar screen is normally circular. This is probably secret information, but that's all right. You know, it's secret even after it's been on television. Anyway, it has a little screen, and there's a little finder that goes round and round and round, and the screen is green. Now, the hypnotic color is green. Green is a hypnotic color. So we have a green screen. That's one of the first things we must do. Please have a green screen. Anyway, this thing goes round and round. It's a little line that goes round and round. It sweeps. And as it goes around, it paints a picture of what the radar antenna up there is looking at. So the way they make a radar operator is to make him study electronics. I don't know what that's got to do with being a radar operator. Radar operator is supposed to be able to analyze what the screen says. And yet he studies his electronics, and they say these knobs and dials and gimme-gahoojits are all focused, and this is the way you focus, and this is the way you unfocus, and this is the way you read distances, and this is the way you do that and this, and when you disconnect that, the whole thing blows up, and this is the way a radar set works. After they taught him how to work it, then they hang a badge on his arm and call him a radar operator. And then the Andre Doria goes down with a great loss of life. Why? Because the fellow was never taught to be a radar operator. He might have been taught to be a radar designer. He might have been taught to be a radar repairman. He's been taught to do everything except to look at a circular hypnotic screen that drives him into a complete trance after about 3 minutes. You ought to see a radar operator. I fell wise to this during the war. I used to come in when the fog was bad and so forth. I'd come in and look at the screen myself off the bridge and just come in and take a look at the sweep and so on and see if we had things clear. Operator was sitting there, but I couldn't guarantee that he was being a radar operator. There was a body sitting in front of a screen. They'd hypnotize. I finally got real clever on this, and I used to put two of them on watch and alternate them every 20 minutes and give the other fellow some plotting or something to do, and I'd just keep them swapping back and forth. Wouldn't let them fixate. But they just go into a complete trance, and if you look at them, their eyelids are fluttering, the eyeball is hunting. You have to get them out of the road sometimes. You move them aside and then move them back into place again, like one of these dummies we were just using. It's the most remarkable thing you ever saw. The whole art and skill of being a radar operator consists of being able to operate a radar. Now, a Scientologist wouldn't overlook this. He's got to go to the lowest gradient of what the job is doing or what the fellow can do. He goes to the highest ability the fellow can reach and he proceeds from there. Now, if a man has great difficulty in sitting still 2 hours at a time without moving, he'll never be a radar operator. So to make a radar operator, you'd have to teach somebody to sit still without moving and practically without breathing for a couple of hours at a time without getting bored. Now, you take these kids from Lord knows what districts, Lord knows what stresses or what homes. The idea of sitting still is just about the same as blowing their brains out to them. You just couldn't ask them to do this. Ask them to be fixed. Well, how would you like to just take somebody off the street and say, well, there's a subject known as yoga. Now, I want you to sit and meditate for 2 hours. Well, some of you have some acquaintance with that. What did it do to him? He never had any practice. You're going to fix him down in a chair. You're not going to give him anything to think about or listen to or anything of the sort, see? You're going to make his total action sitting in a chair for 2 hours. How many people can do it? I don't care what age or training, how many people can do it? Now, let's get worse than this. How many kids can do it? How many young men of 17, 18, 19, how many of these can do it? None. So they just have to leave, that's all. Somebody says they have to sit there in front of that scope, they leave. They don't watch a scope. In fact, well, I think there are hundreds of thousands of radar sets in the armed services at this time. But I seriously doubt, since the one I know has left the service, that there's one radar operator in any armed service in the world. You get the idea? Well, what's that a failure of? Of course, it's a failure of a Navy not to use Scientology. They are sneaking up on it. But what is it mainly a failure of? It's a failure in education. It's a failure in being able to analyze what the situation is. In order to educate, you have to find out what you're trying to educate people into. And then you have to find out who you're trying to educate into it. And if you do these things, you can educate. But if you don't do those things, skip it. Be no use to anybody. We make a man an engineer. We educate him until in the United States, I don't know, he's 56 or 80 or something before we graduate him. And all during this period of time, we're going to make him an engineer, only he's going to specialize in surveying. And during this whole period of time, we have never found out that he is allergic to damp ground. And allergic as well to sloped tables. Never. We're not going to be able to use him outside or inside. Why do we educate him as an engineer? That's because we didn't pick the man to educate or put him in shape to be educated. Isn't that right? Be a signal failure if we omitted this. The fellow obviously can't survey if every evening when the dew comes on, why, he's going to break down out with allergies. He'll stick this a very short time, he will. See? Let's look at the realities of the situation. Let's take somebody with acrophobia and teach him how to be an aviator. Let's put him through ground school for 2 years. And at the end of that expensive time, we find out he has a horrible terror of height. Well, that's a very obvious one. I think somebody someday may do this. But you know nobody when they're enlisting them in the Air Forces. Nobody ever takes a fellow up to the top of the recruiting building and tell him, look over the edge, Johnny. Nobody ever does that. They get very interested in the paperwork. Where is the right name on the right line so that we can assign the right serial number so we can ship him to the right depot to be issued the wrong uniform? That's what they get interested in. Not any of the practicalities of it. Yet we're going to take somebody into the air service and sooner or later that fellow's going to have to fly. He's going to have to stand height. And that's for sure. As a matter of fact, I saw a fellow with claustrophobia one day enlisted into the submarine service. I hope not to see another one. I happened to be in that submarine the day he came aboard. He'd been trained in sub school, Oh, he'd been beautifully trained. He'd just never been in a submarine. He lowered his way down through the hatch and the conning tower and stowed his duffel, and we shoved off from the dock. And all of a sudden, my orders were issued for a dive, and this kid heard the hatches go shut and went nuts. He tried to go right on out through the side of the submarine, even though the captain was standing in his way. And there's just no controlling the boy at all. He had such a terror of closed spaces. The idea of being underwater was just overpowering. Where do you start, then? Where does education start? Well, education starts with Scientology. Education doesn't start with yesterday's education. Because we can parallel it so exactly, because we can be so expert at it, we look very smooth in the field of education. Let me assure you, we look good. But we're not educating anybody. We're putting them into communication. See, that's the trick. We're not educating people. We're putting them into communication in that particular field. Now, I'll tell you how you teach somebody to drive a car. Tell you how you teach somebody to drive a car. You want to know how to teach somebody to drive a car? Well, you go down and you get a learner's permit, and then you get a car, and you put them in the car, and during a heavy traffic hour, why, you show them how to start the motor and you step out. I think that is the standard method. Sometimes they go as far as taking them on a back road. And then everybody is screaming and complaining about the number of motor accidents. No, I'll tell you, this is for true now. I will tell you the reason how to teach a person to drive a car. The truth of the matter is that you just run 8C on the car. Run 8C on the car standing still. ARC is control. That's all there is to it. As a person fails to control things, as he has failures in controlling things, so his ARC drops. You want to know how ARC drops? By his failures to start, stop, and change things. See, he fails in life, start, stop, and change. Girl says, I hate men. She says in the same breath, I have failed to start, failed to stop, and failed to change men to a point where I am at 1.5 on the tone scale. To a Scientologist, this is what she said. She says, I hate men. I have failed to start, stop, and change men. Now, this has an awful lot to do. This has an awful lot to do with an awful lot of personal relations. If control, failure of, results in downscale, all we'd have to do to get somebody upscale would be to put him in communication with something. Isn't that right? Well, actually, it does pick him up the first rungs of that very heavily. I mean, he comes up very well. You just have run 8C on the car. Run 8C on any part of the car. Doesn't matter what. Just keep him at it. Sounds silly, but his car's standing still, isn't going any place, and you have him run 8C on the steering wheel. That would make some sense. Run 8C on the gear shift. That would make some sense. But not 8C on the windshield, 8C on the spark plugs, 8C on the gas tank, 8C on the hubcaps. Funny part is, the more you do of it, the more capable he becomes in driving. It's real wild. Automobile accidents run out and so forth. Now run 8C with it standing still and its motor running. And he'll get used after a while to hearing the motor. More 8C. Next thing we want to do, we want to show him he can stop it. So we put it on a slight grade and we let it roll forward and tell him to put the brakes on. He stops it. Okay. Let it roll forward again. All right, stop it. All right. When he's thoroughly convinced he can stop it, then we show him how to start it. Now, that's the way you teach somebody to drive a car. Actually, you hardly have to teach him to steer it or anything else. If you just went that far with it, he'd say, oh, automobiles, they're easy. See? Nothing to it. We haven't educated him to do a thing. Well, that's very funny. He, by this time, would have figured out practically anything he wanted to have figured out about it, and he'd seen where it all sat, and he would have figured out that the steering wheel was this and that, and we wouldn't have had to have shown him a thing. This is something you could put to test, and you would discover that it's quite remarkable. Of course, a person who's been around vehicles knows quite a bit about vehicles, but I don't know that if you'd take somebody from the middle of Burma and would never seen an automobile, and do this on him, whether he'd wind up driving or not. He probably would, but I couldn't guarantee it. He might be have to be told that livers do something. See, his experience might not have included a remote control lever, like a brake. He'd probably have to be run on 8C down the whole brake line to the brakes or something. Brake shoes, you see. We're taking with a driver in our modern society quite a bit for granted. See, we're taking for granted that he already knows about brakes stopping cars and a lot of gimmickry. So our education starts at a fairly high level. All right. Communication, then, would seem to be one of the great fundamentals of education. And when we add it to our reality and affinity, we add this triangle as a whole in there, and with a new definition on reality and affinity, I'll just tell you in passing, reality from 2.0 down is solid. If you want to know what somebody's reality is from 2.0 down, it's solid. Therefore, anything that communicates to him is solid. He would be in better communication with you if you handed him a ball than if you said hello. Don't you see? Somebody below 2.0. Above 2.0, reality is agreement. And above 22.0 on the tone scale, reality is simply a postulate. Simple as that. So there's where solids came in. Affinity is consideration of distance. You see the reality of terminals and the reality of distances between them, the ideas of interchange. We get ARC fairly well worked out here. It becomes necessary to do that in terms of our new application here to education. All right, now if you could educate somebody by simply making him touch things, and if you knew your Scientology enough to always cut in at the lowest gradient that this person could tolerate and then improve it, and if you were doing a good job as an auditor on this person, you would wind up having educated him. That's for sure. He would be educated. Now, it tells us then that the ARC triangle monitors control and monitors education. So it monitors information, interchange of. That's an incidental monitoring, by the way. I mean, that's not terribly important. What I'm talking to you about isn't very important. It's merely the whole field of education in the universities and schools and grammar schools and teaching children to do things and people to be citizens and so forth. That's all I'm talking about. It's not very important. Anyhow, when we look over this wide field, we discover several things. And amongst the things that we discover is why empires fold up and go to dust. That's the first thing we discover. Why, when we look over countries at large, why they come up on a huge sweep upwards and then go down. Why Rome, once mistress of the world, fell away to a point in 560, I think it was, the total population of Rome was two wolves walking the forum. That's not a very high population. Now, where we see this sort of thing occur, we are very prone to accept it as an inevitable cycle. We're prone to accept it as inevitable, merely because it happens so often. There really isn't any reason why something that happens often has to be inevitable. Just because you have always died, as you live along the line, providing you believed in reincarnation, of course. Just because you've always died is no reason you'll die. Just because it's happened is no reason so on. But people use this as a stable datum. They get happy about this. They get worried about life, and they say, look, it has always happened before, so it'll happen again. George has always come back to me, therefore he'll come back to me again. They make themselves happy this way. Then one fine day, George doesn't turn up. Well, Actually, the downfall of empires is entirely the downfall of its ability to communicate. That's the whole picture. It no longer is able to communicate. It individuates. It falls into bits. It said it is too far from here to Composium. Therefore, we will put a governor up at Composium and forget about the joint. Maybe he'll send taxes to us once every 6 years. Of course, he forgets that the second tax period. And so it starts to fall to pieces. But how could something like this happen? Well, it has happened continually. The empire actually tries to survive. It tries to stay in communication. And if it were just a matter of post roads, keeping them repaired and keeping traffic running up and down, then the empire would last forever. But there's the point in the empire that is really bad, is the empire's inability to keep in communication with its, quote, subject peoples, unquote. Now, its ability to stay in communication with its citizens is not bad. They are, after all, citizens. But underneath these citizens, in most empires of history, there have been, quote, subject peoples, unquote, who weren't citizens. And the empire maybe went along for 300 or 400 years with these subject peoples in its ranks, and even though it one day said to them, you're citizens, it didn't pull it off. Why didn't it pull it off? Because it had neglected the rather elementary step of teaching them what the empire was all about. It may be neglected a much more elementary step than this, teaching them what life was about for a citizen of the empire. What was this rank citizen? And they just said, you're a citizen. The fellow says, well now, what is a citizen? I don't know what a citizen is. Oh yes, I do know what a citizen is. A citizen wears a topi and rides around a rickshaw. Where's a rickshaw? I'll buy a topi someday. I'm a citizen. And then this empire begins to depend on these people in whom it has reposed this trust, and they've never communicated anything about being a citizen or anything about the empire to these people. Boy, I mean, you could cry when you think of the number of corpses strewn across what number of plains has occurred because nobody knew this elementary principle. That empires are built by education. They are not built by the sword. They are preserved by education. They are destroyed by their own use of force. It's a fantastic thing. I mean, it's such an elementary thing. Now, in past days, educators would have come along and they tackled this problem. They said, well, that's very good. Let's tackle the problem. We'll teach everybody to read the Constitution or the Magna Carta or some other document that related to holding the empire together. We'll teach them to do this. We'll teach them to read this. That's fine. Then we will have done a job. No. I'm sorry. But an empire is not a constitution or a Magna Carta. Any government there is, or ever has been, is a myth. It is a collection of individuals. And the sooner we learn that states and governments and peoples are composed of individuals, the happier we're going to be, because we're making a tremendous, fantastic error in doing anything else. You say, I cannot talk to the government. The government will not listen to me. Boy, you certainly uttered a truth. You remember the dragon that St. George killed? Remember that dragon? Well, can you talk to him? Well, he's a myth too. You can't talk to a mythical entity which cannot and does not grant life, which does not bleed, which does not suffer. People get governments and things like that all mixed up with bodies. They think because bodies are full of cells, they think these cells run up and down as individuals in the bloodstream and do all sorts of weird things like this. Then they think of an empire as the central body, one way or the other, which is full of cells, which is to say populations. Well, let me assure you, if cells exist and do what they're supposed to do, they certainly are better trained than the citizens of empires. That's for sure. No, a government really can't be held in any such parallel. A government is a collection of people who agree there's a government there. But no matter how well they agreed, they would still be a group of individuals. And it is the individual who has to be trained. You can't pass a law saying each and every citizen of North Dakota is now fully educated in the principles of the United States government. You can't pass a law and do that. You have to go get them by the ear, sit them down, and educate them. Is that right? It's not within the realm of the sword to teach anybody anything, except beware of swords. And if you teach them well enough to beware of swords, they go buy one. In other words, an empire has a tendency to disenfranchise its citizens before it really consolidates itself into an empire. It really is not an empire the day it decides it is. It maybe has a chance of being one if it can overcome the hate and differences resulting from the violence of conquest. It doesn't matter how much territory it embraces. It doesn't matter how many people are saluting. It has nothing to do with it. It has all of that space and all of those people and all of those borders surrounded. If it's done all that, then it has a chance to become an empire if it educates its people. If. And it can only educate its people if they're willing to be educated. And if they're willing to be educated, and they do get then educated as citizens of the empire, only then would you have an empire, which tells us there's never yet been one on earth. Now, wherever we look across the world today, we find people out of communication with the facts. We take somebody, and he looks at a rifle. What is this rifle? Why, he doesn't even know good HC on his rifle. He doesn't even rightly know what it's for. He can slap it into a manual of arms and this way and that. He can handle it maybe very expertly. But he's handling something that the powers that be consider a good civilizing medium. In fact, the Philippine Islands are a great blot on U.S. history with regard to this. They used to talk about civilizing the Filipino with a Krag Jorgensen, which was the name of the rifle used back around 1900. Civilize them with a Krag. Never been done, never will be done, can't be done. You can kill them with Krags, but you can't civilize them with Krags. In the first place, from what I know of the Tagalog, boy, could he teach the farmers of Iowa a lot about courtesy. So the civilization goes both ways. There is no such thing as a barbarian unless we mean somebody with a beard. Every time you start to teach preclear something, you're going to learn something. That's for sure. And if you're unwilling to learn anything at all from the preacher, you'll never teach him a thing, because his teacher is out of communication with him. Right? As long as his teacher's out of communication with him, you expect him to learn anything? No. About the only way you could really hang an empire together so it would work, well, I shouldn't make such a statement. The only way I can myself see as practical would be to open up communication lines to find out whether or not anybody wanted to be part of that group. And open up the communication lines thoroughly enough so that they'd get over 0.5, 1.1, 1.5, and 2.0 on the subject. In other words, let's keep the communication lines open for a while, regardless of what's running and racing across them. You'll very often find a person who is apathetic about cars, and you're trying to teach him to drive a car. A person who's apathetic about cars in the process of being taught is liable to haul off and start kicking the tires. Liable to say, rah, rah, beat on the doors. I had somebody do this one time. Beat on the door of the car, kicked the running board, stamped on it. Oh, man. But this person was the nicest, calmest person about cars you ever saw before I started teaching him about a car. Calm. Person was in complete apathy on the subject, maybe below apathy. There is a period below apathy which most Thetans occupy with great ease. Now, as we teach this person to drive the car, he comes up through these various tones. He gets apathetic. He gets sad. He becomes afraid. He becomes angry. Becomes antagonistic, he becomes bored with it, and eventually becomes enthusiastic about it. How do you think people would act being introduced to a new group? Well, let's supposing that they had been conquered by force. I don't know how much trouble anybody wants to lay up for himself, but sometime conquer another human being by force, just for fun. You know, conquer them by force, overwhelm them. Jump up on them and hold them down on the bed till they stop squirming. You know? Do something. So not to damage them, you know? Don't damage them. Don't throw them down the floor. They'll either crack their skull or something. Sort of, like something soft, like a gymnasium mat. And just hold them down till they stop squirming, you know? And then start to run it out of them. You, not some other auditor. You have a picnic. You didn't even hurt them. They start up through this. They've been held until they no longer protested. You see, apathy. And they'll feel sad. And they'll feel a little bit scared of you. And then they'll start to get mad. And by the time they come up to 2.0 antagonism, you're liable to be slugged, whether you slug them or not. Now the contest becomes whether or not you, as an auditor, are willing to bear with it until they again get up to a point of where they can be your friend. That's the contest. Can you take it enough to let them actually recover their proper tone level? What do you think happens to a country that goes out by right of conquest, whatever that is, force of arms, and subjugates a people, and then tries to be nice to them? What do you think is going to happen to them? Well, what's going to happen to the person who made the conquest, and what's going to happen to those people? If the conquest isn't held on to while the people are being educated up into a new status or beingness, they're going to kick back with great violence, aren't they? There's going to be an awful disturbance connected with this recovery. The thing to do is to hold on. Don't let go. Keep auditing them. Don't back up. Don't blow the session yourself as an auditor. Now, if you did that, and if they were educated into what being a citizen was in your standpoint, and if you were willing to listen what being a citizen was according to them, that's very important, you see, why, you would wind up with a friendly ally. But if it's done some other way, if you held them down on the gymnasium mat until they no longer squirmed, bringing them back up through that course is the test for a very strong man, a very strong person. An auditor can do this because he's trained to. But he's liable to be kicked around in the process if he has done that trick, because, you see, it was he himself who did this. Now, the odd part of it is that modern processing does permit it to happen. You can actually do it with modern processes. It has been done, this exact experiment which I'm telling you about. without the auditor getting his silly head knocked off. The process worked faster than the applied duress. In other words, the preclear was coming up tone on these various points faster than the preclear was able to retaliate. That requires an awful lot of communication then, doesn't it? Well, when we communicate today on such a process as keep him from going away, you know, that's an awful lot of communication very suddenly. It does quite a bit. There's quite a change occurs in a case. We can do that today. We can even do this trick of putting somebody under duress and then getting them entirely over it. But the only way that I know of, and that doesn't mean it's the only way by a long way, that an empire could be solidly built would be on the principles of good education. It would have to educate its peoples and have to be willing to be educated amongst those peoples. And if this were done, then it would become possible for governments to become possible. You see, I don't even know at this time whether they're possible or not. Somebody made a wisecrack to me the other day. He said, "Do you think decent people should be permitted to associate with governments?" But the tremendous task of handling the personal relations of a very large number of people is not one that is lightly undertaken. And there exists on Earth today, in Scientology, for the first time that we have any knowledge of at all, the means by which man might possibly be welded into an empire. But the funny part of it is Scientology doesn't have as any part of its principles that it wants to. That's an interesting side comment on it. But if civilizations are to exist, if they are to go forward, and if man is to progress, if these older cultures are to pass away, that is with some sadness that I would watch some of these old cultures pass away. I don't necessarily believe in machine progress. I don't necessarily believe we're better off for being able to drive swiftly to Birmingham. I think it once upon a time was possibly much more interesting to walk. Look at how long you would be out of sight from all of the business worries and things that were bothering you. All I see in modern society is an inhibition of your ability to duck. But if we are going forward toward an industrialization of these older societies, then we do have in our hands the means and technologies by which this can be done rather easily and with considerable satisfaction, because it could be done in such a way that the people who were being, quote, improved, unquote, or, quote, civilized, unquote, would not particularly feel they were being put under duress, and they would reserve to a very marked degree their own characteristics. It would not be possible to invite somebody's willingness and then break him out of his basic personality. Let me call that to your attention. I mean, that is not a possibility. If people are willingly becoming civilized, they will become as civilized as they're willing to be civilized. Now, it becomes possible then at this day and age to have peace on earth. But at the same time, there exists a completely impossible weapon, which isn't a weapon at all, which says that peace on earth is not likely to occur. We're sort of at a crossroads. Which of us are going to get there first? Us Scientologists or them other fellas? We're not even going to regard the stupid in between. They won't be anything unless the atomic physicist makes them something, and that's a corpse. Or unless we make them something, which is real high tone. But which way man goes from this point is actually not the question. We do have the means by which man could improve himself and his societies. We have them in Scientology, in its application to education, because we can educate people today, perhaps for the first time. And the main question, which of course faces man at this time, is he going to live long enough to avail himself of this material? And of course, that's all up to a throw of the die, a flip of the coin, and other such chances, or perhaps to our own abilities and endeavors. Now, man's world is a shaken, rather chaotic place today. It's a world of experts. And we ourselves are liable to get too expert. We Scientologists are liable to become far, far too expert, so that we forget that there are mechanisms that other people use that serve them quite well. Now, because we can take all those mechanisms away from them, wholesale lots, just remember that all those mechanisms make a game, and some people like that game. So it requires a certain amount of branding of beingness on your part to let the other fellow play a game. The only game which I don't think we dare let the other fellow play is blow up Earth. And if we can influence the stopping of that in any way, I think we're more or less honor-bound to do so. Scientology actually offers a very happy future. The look into the future for Scientology itself is very, very pleasant. It's not interested in building empires. As a matter of fact, it cautions everybody. It says, now be loyal to your own state. We tell the Egyptians and the Greeks and anybody else, be loyal to your own state. Now remember, you're a citizen of Greece. They look at me and they look at us and they say, what you talking about? I'm a citizen of Scientology. Well, that may be as it is. They are, to a large degree, a citizen of a new state of mind, a state of mind that can understand and that wants to. Thank you.